Well, I think Salim actually did and said everything I was planning to, so we can wrap up. No. But thank you, Salim, for putting so much on the table and really provoking a lot of questions and a lot of thinking, and hopefully it will lead to some very fruitful discussion and ultimately action. Speaking of action, since I am very aware that we just had lunch and might be feeling a little bit sluggish, I'm gonna ask everybody to please just stand up for a moment. Stand up and greet the person behind you. Okay, now greet the person to your left and the person to your right. And if there is no one, wave to us down here. Yes, siyavuka. That's what we say in South Africa. And siyavuka means we are waking up. And indeed, I'm very excited by what I see here today, because it shows that people know what's going on and they want more information so that information can further inspire them to take action. So I'm grateful to all of you here today, and indeed, I think we're ready to build a movement. All of us are aware of the incredible resistance through grassroots movements in South Africa that exposed apartheid to the world. People organized themselves into formidable street committees, holding boycotts, lobbying, marching, having sit-ins, and other mass actions that brought apartheid to its knees. Sadly, that also led many of our people to flee the country because of the unbearable conditions. And many were forced into exile, as we see today that so many of our Palestinian brothers and sisters have been forced into exile. Part of the resistance agenda was to conscientize, educate, mobilize, and mobilize the support of the international community. It happened in many ways, through an endless series of South African speakers, activists, and artists who toured the world, telling the story of what was going on in South Africa to the world, and bringing a new consciousness about in terms of how we understood colonization and how colonization had moved to what we know as apartheid, and how violent and brutal and savage it was. And while it stood in accusation, saying that in fact it was those who were oppressed, who were inhuman, who were savage, and who needed to be rescued by apartheid itself. Now, if that isn't a grand irony, I don't know what is. Again, this resistance movement happened in many ways, and we were fortunate to be blessed by many a speaker who came to Canada to talk about what was happening and to encourage us to form those critical alliances that would urge us not only to have discussions, but that would allow us to really see and strategize around where we could make a difference on the ground. Now, I think it's very important that we're having this discussion here at the University of Toronto. If you recall, back in the days of apartheid, the University of Toronto was one of the biggest investors of apartheid and promoters of apartheid policies in terms of its investments. And today, as we reflect on UFT and the fact that it has now been able to boast of receiving $1 billion in its fundraising efforts, I think that alone should raise many an eyebrow as to where that money came from. So I urge you today to start investigating and looking through the books and checking the records of who indeed upholds the university and its values and its principles, which are more and more shifting towards a neoliberal corporate agenda that does not seek to engage the will, the desires, and visions of students, but seeks to appease and reward those of corporations who entice the university with big, big dollars. Let me shift back a little bit. As I said previously, we were lucky and fortunate to have many a speaker come to Canada to tell us about what was happening in South Africa. From Mandela himself, to the Reverend Chikane, to Bishop Tutu, to Winnie Madikizela Mandela, and many, many, many others, labor activists, artists, activists, people who had been imprisoned, came here and told us their stories. And through them, we were inspired to have fundraising events and to demand corporate accountability, which resulted ultimately in divestment and boycott campaigns, and as well as recognizing the critical role that was played by the labor movement here in Toronto, around Canada, and, you know, and the links that it made directly with South Africa and other labor movements, which Salim touched on briefly. Now, it is these kinds of links that we have to desperately encourage, because it was those very types of links that ultimately affected major, major, major change and took us away from theorizing and pontificating to actual grassroots movement and action. We must also look at the role of the arts. Music and theater, in particular, ensured the voices and experiences of the oppressed became personalized and were made tangible and through their poignancy. Here in Toronto, there was a consistent commitment to have South African theater productions come, and these productions were phenomenal in that they not only kept the struggle alive, but through their brilliance, through their artistic nature, and through the stories they were telling us about what was happening on the ground in South Africa, they mobilized the people, because ultimately they unsettled the people. People became deeply disturbed by what they saw and started to ask questions and started to investigate further. Some of those productions were Woza Albert, Asina Mali, You Strike a Woman, You Strike a Rock, Sizwe Banzi Is Dead, and many, many others that kept audiences spellbound through their artistic genius. And even while we listened to apartheid telling us that these were savages and these were people who had very, very little intellectual and artistic capacity, the brilliance of their creative gifts is what asserted these phenomenal productions. So much loved was South Africa for its art that one very effective awareness campaign was Arts Against Apartheid that took place here in Toronto. A number of restaurants, nightclubs, and music halls, stage events all around the city. And artists committed themselves not only to celebrating the music and art of South Africa, but they themselves were able to contribute through their own artistic voices. And these were very important ways that we were able to make creative strategic links that went deeper than our political alliances or our political thinking, because our art and our craft and our creativity was able to touch people's hearts, was able to go deep, deep down and reach our very humanity. And I think as we look at what is happening in Palestine, in Lebanon, and other parts of the Arab world in relation to racist Zionist apartheid practices, we cannot forget. We must encourage the very same. We must encourage and listen to their stories. We must give them voice. We must encourage the making of films, the writing of books, so that we ensure we capture their stories, their history. Because as we know, the power of the apartheid machinery will always try to drown those voices out. And so this is one of the reasons why we are gathered here today, to bring attention to those voices, to talk about their struggles and strategize in very concrete ways as to what we can do to bring about a renewed anti-apartheid movement around the world. And we're doing it. Siavuka. As was stated last night, apartheid regimes never concede to any type of humanity or morality. The very nature of apartheid is violent, cold, uncaring, and based on very sophisticated systems of degradation, humiliation, violence, and destruction. Apartheid is nothing less than a form of genocide because it destroys everything and only the resistance and mobilization of the people at home and abroad can force it to change. Apartheid is also a form of slavery, relying on cheap labor of the people to make it operate and to keep its machinery going. And so, just as we saw in South Africa, where huge numbers of people were forced onto Bantustans, those very same people were still forced to give cheap and sometimes free labor to the apartheid regime, ensuring that its mechanisms would continue to stay alive in spite of the ways in which apartheid was systematically destroying those people, their communities, their families, their values, and their very essence. I would like to take a moment to talk about South Africa today and some of the things we should and could have done better to ensure true liberation there during our struggle. In many ways, I believe we were not critical or analytical enough. For instance, we were naive to believe that only supporting one primary liberation organization, especially one that was never known to be radical in its vision, guiding principles, or practices. We were wrong to do this, and I think Salim alluded to this earlier, that we really have to do our research and homework and listen to the voices of the people on the ground when they tell us which organizations really stand for the people. And so it's important for us to ask questions of those who purport to be leading the struggle of the people. What is their history? What is their background? What is their true commitment? Do they have a hidden agenda? And what kinds of things have they actually been able to affect? What is their record? And over again, we see, as I look particularly at the situation in South Africa, that we didn't ask those questions enough, nor did we look as deeply as we should and could have at the records of some of those who called themselves our leaders, but who had other agendas. Those organizations that were more revolutionary were skillfully sidelined by those who had their own imperialist, neo-capitalist agendas. And we see that today in South Africa. We rarely talk about white supremacy and white privilege, yet they continue to dictate everything we do in South Africa, even though apartheid is supposed to be dead and gone. I would argue that, in fact, apartheid is very much alive, not only in South Africa, but right here in Canada, as we look at what's happening to Aboriginal peoples. As we look at the struggle of the Six Nations people in particular, and see how mainstream Canada seems to think that it's okay for Aboriginal people still to be denied rights to their land. And in South Africa, we're fighting the very same struggle. And of our leaders, we must also ask, what happened to our land? And that we want our land back, as we see the land grab that is going on in Zimbabwe next door, and South African leaders having to reassure their neo-colonial partners and masters that nothing of the sort will take place there. And yet, the energy of the people, their frustration, and their dire situation compels them to demand land as part of the reparations that they deserve and are entitled to. So here in Canada, we have to also ask the same questions concerning what is happening to our brothers and sisters in the Aboriginal community. Beyond that, we also have to recognize that apartheid practices are very much alive in this society. Report after report talk about the fact that Canada is becoming a place where we will soon have a majority of racialized people who are becoming and will become the permanent underclass in this city in particular. I think that raises some very, very disturbing questions about what we claim to believe as Canadians. Canada is known around the world for being a safe haven, as being a country that stands up for democracy, as being a country that is passionately committed to equity, justice, and fairness for all. And yet when we look at the reality of the things that are taking place in Canada, this is certainly not the case. And sadly, more and more of us are beginning to ask questions and raise our voices, challenging our leaders, those who claim to speak on our behalf, and asking them why it is that even though we work just as hard, even though we came to this country with skills and with all kinds of dreams, that somehow some of us don't seem to be entitled to have a decent and fulfilling life. We have to make those connections. We have to look at the ways in which racialized communities in this country are systematically denied opportunities, are underdeveloped, are some of whom are becoming unemployable because their skills, their knowledge, and their visions are not being realized in this country that claims to stand for democracy. So I think that forces us to really re-examine what democracy is, and not just here in Canada, but around the world, when we see that racism is becoming more and more rampant, and yet becoming more and more socially acceptable as something that's just part of how life is. There's something very, very wrong, and I'm talking specifically now about South Africa. I went back to South Africa in 1994 and was there until 2001. And these were just some of my observations. There's something very wrong when the vast majority of South Africans are treated as if they're invisible and only matter when free and cheap labor is needed by the state, big business, farmers, or private citizens. The literal flooding of South Africa by wealthy international corporations resulted in cheaper labor, less power for workers, and endless restrictions being implemented to prevent workers from standing up for their rights. There's something very wrong when the government continues to make deals with the likes of Dr. Death, Walter Besson, who admittedly made a variety of poisonous substances that would kill masses of Africans. And we cannot overlook the sudden scourge of AIDS and how it became so rampant in such a short space of time. I would argue, and many have already, that it is indeed part of a silent genocide campaign. There's something very wrong when Nobel Peace Prize winner ex-president de Klerk tells blacks they should be grateful to whites for giving up power. and whites in general feign amnesia and are forever telling us to move on and forget the past because we now have a level playing field. I could go on and on, but would like to very quickly close with touching on some of the initiatives that we should seriously consider taking up now as we're talking about boycotts. To begin with, I think we need to boycott Starbucks. Right? I mean, Starbucks just seems like the most logical place to start. Because Starbucks is actually Jewish run, Jewish owned, and the monies that Starbucks generates go directly to support the Israeli army and buy guns and bullets and uniforms and a whole lot of other military hardware to ensure that their war keeps going. We also need to challenge Winners, because Winners sells beauty products that are made in Israel. So those are very, you know, two very simple things that we can do as we engage other more complex initiatives and actions. But in closing, I would like to say that we must resist our impulse to accept shallow notions of democracy and liberation. Our flag, for example, in South Africa, isn't our own. Some foreigner came to South Africa and designed our flag for us. Shame. Things are worse in Palestine because they dare to disrupt the lives of Jewish settlers, and we have to name that. In South Africa, we didn't do that. And really, I think to some extent, we knew our place. We knew where we belonged. And while we did dare to affect change, to disrupt and to rupture apartheid, we didn't seriously focus on disrupting the lives of colonial settlers. And so I think that that's one of the things we seriously need to think about in South Africa as we continue to engage the very, very serious realities of what still living under neo-apartheid means. And so in closing, I would say that we should make no mistake that apartheid in South Africa is far from over, and that we need to re-examine the conditions under which South Africans are living, not only there, but here in Toronto. We need to look at, for example, the fact that Bay Street here in Toronto is run largely by South African monies and South African people. And yet, when we look at what's happening to Black South Africa abroad, internationally, those voices are seldom heard. And because we assume that freedom has come to South Africa because we see or used to see the likes of Nelson Mandela traveling the world, shaking hands and kissing the hand of the Queen, that somehow things have really, really changed in South Africa. And so, in closing, I would like to read this very quick.
We're really running out of time.
Please, 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 very quickly. Okay, so it's a statement that comes from Israel and South Africa, A Natural Alliance by Robert Ashmore, was written in 1988. And he says, in May 1988, Israel and South Africa celebrated a 40th anniversary. Jews in Israel and abroad commemorated 40 years of Zionist control over land seized from Palestinians and proclaimed as a Jewish state on May 14, 1948. In South Africa, the Afrikaners celebrated coming to power in the May 26, 1948 elections on an apartheid platform that has guided the course of national party politics for the last four decades. So there is no question that imperialist, Zionist, apartheid practices in South Africa and in the Jewish state are the same thing. Thank you.
Thank
Amanda!
You.
Amanda! Amanda! Gawetu.